about this time every summer, as we approach July 4th, this is when my brother and I would start running out of fireworks. Because every year, the weeks leading up to July 4th is when we would stock up, not for the holiday, but for the rest, the remainder of the year. And we didn't want all the cool things. We didn't want mortars or sparklers or snakes or chimichus or whatever they are. We wanted bottle rockets and Roman candles and nothing else. Every other firework is a waste of your money and it's a waste of your time. Don't waste your money. Buy bottle rockets and Roman candles. And everything that Zach and I would do involved these fireworks. We would make paper airplanes and strap bottle rockets to them and shoot them at each other. We would play airsoft gun wars and it would turn into a bottle rocket war. Everything we did had fireworks. We grew up in Branson, in the boonies of Branson, and so there wasn't much else to do. But we had two games that we would play all the time. One of them was called Storm the Porch. And at my parents' house, they live on a hill. If this were the back porch, there's about 10 feet of flat ground, just like here, between the stage and you all. And then it's a hill, and it slopes down for about 30 yards. And so in Storm the Porch, what would happen is Zach and his buddies would be up on the back porch with Roman candles. Me and my friends would be at the bottom of the hill, and we would each have a trash can lid. And the goal was to run up the hill while they shot Roman candles at us and try and touch the porch. Now, as I've grown in wisdom, the only thing I disagree with is that I never got a chance to shoot at Zach. We were always at the bottom of the hill running up. He never was. And so that was one of our all-time favorite games. Every afternoon in the summer, that's what we would play, Storm the Porch. And we would also do another game that has no name because it was the greatest one we would play. We would buy moon travelers. These are the bottle rockets we wanted. They're the best. You don't want to report on it. It doesn't make a whistle. It just zooms past you and then explodes. And we would buy gross after gross of these. If you don't know what a gross is, it's 144 pieces. So in this particular game, we would take one gross. We would go to the driveway and we would rip every bottle rocket off of its stick. And we would line them in a circle so that all the wicks were touching. Now, the goal was to light them and then run. When you light those wicks all together, it's like you set a bonfire off in the middle of your driveway. Our goal was you had to wait a second. So we would stand there, you'd look at it, you'd count 1,000, and then you could begin to run. The goal was just to find freedom behind something. You didn't want to get stuck out in the open. And sometimes they would ignite a little bit faster and you'd get hit. Other times you would make it. But I have fond memories thinking I was in a movie as bottle rockets are zizzing past my ear and I run and I dive behind a hay bale. Remember, we lived in Branson in the boonies, so those are out there. Or hiding behind a tree. But the whole goal of the game was not to get caught, not to get stuck out in the open. And it would happen and you wouldn't make it and you would get hit and it stings a little bit. But that was the thrill. You know, could you make it to safety? Could you escape? Or would you be stuck and would you feel the sting? But in this life, there are things that we do get stuck in that don't necessarily just sting. They actually do hurt. And there are situations that we're trying to escape and it isn't nearly as much of a thrill. It's more so terrifying. And we're not sure how to do it. And rather than giggling as you think you're in a movie, you might be running away in fear, unsure if you'll make it out. And those are the moments where we feel stuck. And I think if we were all to ask ourselves this question, have I ever felt stuck? Have you ever felt stuck? All of us would say yes. And I mean truly stuck. Not stuck in Jim and Jennifer Freeman's driveway running away from bottle rockets, but stuck in a bad relationship. Whether that be with friends who, wherever you're at, begin to discuss and do things that you're not sure you should partake in, and you feel stuck of, okay, if I'm with them, I have to be with them, but if I leave, they might not like me anymore, they might get mad, and you're just stuck and you don't know what to do. Or a bad relationship with a significant other where boundaries have been crossed, but you still truly care for them, but you're not sure what you should do, and how do you find the tension between caring for them and also leaving them? Or maybe you feel stuck in a relationship at home that's moved into abuse and you've been abused in the past and you have no idea how to control what's going on and you feel like you can't tell anybody, but you have nowhere else to go and you're just stuck reliving the same horror and the same nightmare day after day. And maybe it's an addiction. You know, maybe it's you're addicted to pornography and you can't get away from your computer or your phone. Maybe you're addicted to your mirror, and the insecurities in your life drive you to your mirror every morning to get ready for school before you take a picture. Whatever it is, you can't stop thinking about yourself because of the insecurities that run your life. We all have been stuck, and when we get stuck, we want to find freedom. And I actually think it's really natural that we would seek for our freedom in the absence of whatever we're stuck in. So when we feel this way, we try and just remove what's hurting us. Here's the example. My son, 11 months ago, came home. And as Carissa and I brought Truett home for the first time, a few days later, we received a call that our son had cystic fibrosis. Now, praise the Lord, he does not have cystic fibrosis. That's part of the story. But we got an incorrect call from one of the nurses, and for about 48 hours, we're under the assumption that he had this disease. And so I remember feeling so stuck as I held my son in our bed weeping, thinking, how am I going to get out of this? And my thought process went through this. If I could just get rid of this disease, man, if I could just create a cure for this, then everything would be fine. I'd find freedom from this heartache that I have that my son is going to hurt for the rest of his life. If I could just get away from this situation, if I could just remove this from him, and this is what we think freedom is, just the removal of something in our life. If I could just get rid of the insecurities, then I wouldn't deal with this depression anymore. If I could just get rid of the hurts, then this abuse in my past wouldn't haunt me today. If I could get rid of the heartaches, then that breakup that still messes with me wouldn't be so prevalent in my life, and I'd finally have freedom. This is what we think freedom is, the absence of whatever it is. The problem is I've never been able to get rid of a heartache on my own. I've never been able to undo hurts by myself, and I can't just pluck insecurities out of my life whenever I choose to. And with Truett, I couldn't get rid of cystic fibrosis. And so when we reach this point where we've tried everything to gain our own freedom, to get ourselves unstuck, I think we begin to ask another question, and we say, God, where are you? And maybe you haven't asked it that way. Maybe you said something more like, God, are you real? Do you even care? Are you here? Do you see me? Do you know me? Do you understand what I'm going through? But we begin to ask these questions because we realize we're hopeless by ourselves. As I held Truett, I said, God, I can't do this. I don't know how to raise a son this way. Father, I'm unable to change this situation, and because of all of that, I feel alone. Insert your story. Insert you being stuck. But eventually we reach this point and we cry out to the Lord, where are you? And I do think he answers. I don't think he always answers how we wish he would. Because laying on my bed, I wish he would have said, Caleb, I heard you. I'm going to take every pain your son will ever feel away. That would have been a great answer to my prayer. But that isn't what he said. And I think what God actually, the way he answers us when we're stuck is through his name. And through one name specifically, Yahweh. Some of you might have heard this name of God before, but what we're going to do today is I'm going to explain to you where it comes from. It comes from the Exodus story. We're going to look at why God gives himself this name, and then we'll figure out why this is the answer to our feeling of being stuck. Why God answers our troubles with this name. Before we do that, we have to understand something. God's name is a little bit different than our name. You know, my name's Caleb, and that identifies me. If I asked you all to point at Caleb, you would point towards me because you know who I'm talking about. But it doesn't describe me. It doesn't describe or express part of who I am. There are some names in the English language that does that. Hunter is one of them. I mean, Hunter explains part of who he is and identifies him. The dude was born in a tree stand. He knows how to double fist a Canadian goose and a mallard duck. And I know you think he looks cute over here with Hershey, this chocolate lab. He's about to wring its neck. He's a stone cold, savage killer. And that's why he was named that name, because his dad wanted him to kill animals when he grew up. And so Hunter's name not only identifies him, but it also describes part of who he is. And the same is true for God's name. Yahweh not only identifies our God, that I would say, I worship Yahweh, and you would know who I'm talking about, it also expresses and describes some of him. So that by the end of this talk, when I say Yahweh, you will not only think of God, but you'll also you'll also understand part of who he is. You know, Amy said that Yahweh is the personal name of God that not only identifies him, but also describes him by expressing his existence and his nearness. And I actually think that's a really good summary of it. That the name of God, Yahweh, his personal name, it identifies him, but it also tells us who he is by expressing his existence and hone in on that last word, nearness. That's what Yahweh's all about, presence and nearness. So let's take a look at the Exodus story and see where this name comes from. Exodus 2 says, during those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning and remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. The people cried out as they were in slavery. The Hebrews, the Israelites, are enslaved by the Egyptians. It doesn't say it here, but I imagine they felt stuck. As many of their kids were being murdered, as Pharaoh put a law in, as they were tortured, as they were forced to work, cruel, 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 they felt stuck. And they began to cry out to God saying, where are you? And God doesn't just hear their cries, as it says here, he also answers their cries. He talks to Moses a chapter later and he says, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Which to us on reading, we might go, okay, great. Why do I care that Moses' granddad and his daddy's daddy and all these daddy's daddies, were worshiping this God? Well, it'll make sense here in a little bit. But that's where God starts and he says, hey, I was with your fathers and I was with the people before you. And the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. And so I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land and into a good and spacious land. And he continues, and he says, look, all their cries have reached me. I've seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them, so now go. I'm sending you, Moses, to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. God hears the cry of the people. They say, we're stuck. Where are you, God? And he says, look, I was with your parents. I was with their parents. And now I'm here with you. And we see that play out a little more as he and Moses begin to further dialogue. Moses hears that God is sending him and he says, wait, who am I? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And he begins to question himself. It makes sense. I think we all might have said that if God looks at us and goes, I'm going to use you to free an entire nation. There's probably part of us, those insecurities that we get stuck in, will begin to say, wait, who am I? And God's response to him is, I will be with you. And I think it's the first time I read this. I hear Moses, I'm trying to picture it in my mind, and I hear Moses say, who am I? And God goes, I will be with you. And I go, wait a second. Is God being a jerk and just completely discredited Moses' question and didn't answer it at all? Moses asked who he is, and God started talking about himself. But I think if you really look at it, God perfectly answers Moses' question. When Moses says, who am I that you should send me? God says, it doesn't matter who you are. What matters is that I'm with you. I'm not so concerned if you think you are or not good enough. What I'm concerned with is my presence, and my presence was with your forefathers, and my presence is with you. Moses, you want to learn to identify yourself. Stop asking who you are and start asking who I am, because you're dependent on me, and your identity is completely wrapped up in the ability to say that I am with you. God's answer to Moses is the perfect answer. And so they continue to talk. God says, I'm going to use you. This will be your sign. You'll come back here and worship me. And Moses says to God, okay, well, suppose I go to the Israelites and I say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask, well, what's his name? What then shall I tell them? And God says to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you're to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. And it's in this phrase, I am who I am, that we actually get the name Yahweh. The Israelites thought it was too holy to utter the name of God out loud. And so rather than saying this phrase in Hebrew, Echya Asher Echya, they would just take vowels from another name, Adonai, mix it with it, and they came up with Yahweh. And when they said Yahweh, they would think of this phrase and understand its meaning, but they wouldn't have to say it, because to say the personal name of God was far too holy for any mouth to say. And so God gives this answer. Hey, you want to know what my name is? I am who I am. Which really, again, sounds funny. But what God is expressing is that he's independent of everything. When Moses says, hey, what's your name? And God goes, I am who I am. I guarantee you Moses shuddered and began to say, well, who am I? Because any answer Moses could have given, it would have been quite strange to think about what God would have said. Moses could have said, well, I'm a man, and God would say, I am. Moses could say, I was born, and God would say, I am. Moses could say, I'm a Hebrew, and God would say, I am. Moses would say, I'm from Egypt, and God would say, I am. Everything that identifies Moses is dependent on something else. God is independent of everything. He's the all-creating, all-magnificent, all-powerful, I am who I am. He's the ising one. He just is. It doesn't matter what's around him. What matters is him. Everything else defines itself off of him. He doesn't define himself by anything else. And what's really neat is his name, I am who I am, is actually a play on the words, I will be with you. I really think you could translate I am who I am as I will be with you, that I will be with you. God not only expresses his existence and his power and his independence, but then he expresses his willingness in his independence to meet us, to be with us, to be present with people. The God who's all powerful and dependent on nothing chooses to walk with people. And that's what he says his name is. The all-powerful, existing one who actually hears the cries of his people, was with them and will be with them. And he continues. He says, this is my name forever. The name you shall call me from generation to generation. God says, this is the name that we're to know him by. You and I, because we're generation to generation, we're to know him as Yahweh. The great I am, the one who is and independent on nothing, but the one who is personally present. Now that can be a bit to look at, and it can be a bit hard to follow. I've made a graph. Now that you're out of school, you get to look at another one that might summarize it a little better. The words and quotations are what we see in Scripture. The other words are just what I thought might be good summaries of it. But what you see is that the people cry out as they're stuck in slavery. They say, God, where are you? We're unable to change our circumstance on our own. I can't fix this on my own. I don't know what to do. We're all alone here. Where are you? And God answers them by saying, I'm the God of your fathers. I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which again to us might not mean anything. But to them, what God is saying, hey, I have always been here. I was there when I created Adam. I was there when I made a promise to Abraham. I was there when I made that same promise to Isaac. And when I carried that promise to Jacob, I was there. And then when I carried that same promise to Joseph, and he got sold into slavery and bought out of a well and rose to power in Egypt, hey, I was still there. And as you're crying out, guess what? I've never left you. I'm still here. They ask where he was, and he goes, I've always been here. I am who I am. And then Moses says, well, who am I? Basically saying, how could I be the one used? And God says, I will be with you. In essence, he says, hey, you want to know who you are? You're the one who is with me. Everything about you is dependent on me. Your freedom is dependent on me. And Moses says, well, what's your name? Who are you? And God says, I am who I am. You want to know who I am? I'm the one that's with you. And then he furthers it and says, this is my name forever. Basically saying, I'll always be here. And so that whole conversation that takes place over two chapters, if you read the far right column, what you see is that God basically answers the cry of the people by saying, hey, remember, I've always been here. You guys are the ones with me. I'm the one with you, and I'll always be with you. The Egyptian cried out for freedom, and God didn't come down and just say, hey, I'm going to take away every pain you ever have. He offered them something even better. He said, I'm going to be present with you, and I have, and I will be forever. You see, the primary freedom that God offers the Israelites is not an escape, but his presence. And so this natural thinking that we have that freedom is an escape from what we're struggling with, I actually think Bob Hamp has it right when he says, freedom's not the absence of something, but the presence of someone. And I would say, namely, that someone is God. Freedom is found in the presence of God, and Yahweh tells us that God is our freedom and that God is present with us. I am who I am, the all-existing, ever-present, eternal, glorious, all-magnificent, all-powerful God of the universe is actually present with you. And that's his answer over and over as we get stuck and we say, God, where are you? I've tried to get rid of these insecurities. I've tried to get rid of this hurt. I've tried to get rid of this pain. I can't escape this relationship. As we feel stuck and cry out to him, God might not answer us how we think, but he does answer us this way. You see, as I held true it and said those words, where are you? I do think God answered me. And he came and he sat in my bed with me and he put his arm around me and said, Caleb, just as you love your son, I love you. And though you hurt, I too know what it means to hurt. And I will never leave you and I'm here with you. You might not be able to do this, but guess what? You can because you're with me. And I've chosen to be with you and I'll never leave you. And in the same way as we cry out going, Lord, I need freedom from this addiction. Why can't I put my phone down? Why am I afraid to look in the mirror every morning? Why can't I get rid of this anxiety? I don't know if God comes down and just says, hey, let me take all those things away. I think he offers you something better. When he says, rather than just taking all the pain away, let me give you myself. Let me be present with you. The great I am says, I want to be with you. I've been with everyone before you. I'm telling you, you're with me and I'm with you and I'll be here forever. You don't have to do any of this alone. Stop thinking your freedom comes from escaping and start believing that your freedom's found in my presence and know that I'm present with you from here forward. That's what he told the Israelites. That's what he told me and that's what he tells you. Freedom isn't about gaining something new or getting rid of something old. Freedom is about sitting in the presence of God and trusting him. Look, the Israelites experienced that. They were freed from the Egyptians. That's great. They felt bondage to their doubt. They felt bondage to the Assyrians, to the Babylonians, to the Romans, whatever it is. But all along the way, God said, remember, your freedom is in me and in my presence. And I want to be with you so bad that my son has taken on flesh. And he's here to walk with you, to live a life that you can't, to die a death that you deserve so that you can live with him in his resurrection. And now we walk with the Holy Spirit. There's never been a day in my life since I came to know the Lord that I've walked alone. There's never been a day in my life that I've endured a situation where I was stuck, that I was by myself. But in everything in my life, I walk with the great I am, the most powerful and the most present God of the universe is indwelt in you. He's never leaving you. He was with your parents. He was with the world. He's with you, and he'll be with you forever. And that's where we find our freedom. And we celebrate that freedom as we take communion. As you pick up this cup and you drink it, it's as if Jesus' blood was poured out. Because this is the blood of the new covenant that was poured out for many that we might walk in new life. And as you take this cracker and eat it, you remember the body of Jesus, which was broken for you. And for the forgiveness of sins, the body that bore what we deserved. But at the same time, we remember his new body and his resurrection. And we remember that his presence as he conquered death goes with us forever. Not until you die, but for eternity. This is the God we remember, and this is Yahweh, the great I am who we worship. And so I'll invite you who have professed faith in Jesus to come and take communion. As the band begins to sing and worship, sing with them, but come. This is your invitation here. Come remember Christ, who is the fulfillment of the presence of God and who we look look forward to as we spend eternity in his presence.